Welcome to Crowd and Crozier. I'm your host, Patrick Brown. This episode is something of a milestone for us, as it's our first ever conversation with a former U.S. presidential candidate. Our guest is Rick Santorum, who twice contested the race for the highest executive office in the United States of America, first in 2012 and then in 2016. Prior to his presidential runs, he served in the U.S. Congress for 16 years, the first four in the House of Representatives, followed by 2 6-year terms in the Senate, representing the state of Pennsylvania. A devout Catholic, devoted husband, and father of 7 kids, Rick was a stalwart pro-life champion during his time in office, with his signature accomplishments including helping to shepherd a ban on partial birth abortion into law. In our conversation with Rick, we talk about the 2024 presidential election cycle, what he makes of the current crop of candidates, his own experience on the campaign trail, the surprising absence of authentic solidarity among Catholics on Capitol Hill, ensuring our faith guides our politics rather than the other way around, and the need for happy, hopeful warriors in the public square. If you haven't yet subscribed to Crown and Crozier, please head on over to wherever you get your podcasts and sign up. Hope you're continuing to enjoy all things church, state, and faithful citizenship. Thanks for listening in.
There are two swords, and the question is, which sword is superior, the spiritual sword or the temporal sword?
And without God, democracy will not and cannot long endure.
I die His Majesty's good servant, but God's first.
Welcome to Crown and Crozier, Rick Santorum. Honored and delighted to have you as a guest.
Well, thank you, Patrick. It's great to be on your program. Look forward to the conversation.
If you'll pardon the liturgical paraphrase, I think it's only right and just to kick off our program's first ever interview with a former presidential candidate by talking about the presidential campaign that's underway. For those following at home, we're recording this conversation in late October 2023, so on the Democratic side, current signs are that incumbent President Joe Biden will be the nominee. On the Republican side, 8 candidates qualified for the first primary debate back in August, 7 for the second debate in September. On the independent side, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has declared plans for an independent campaign. So a general question just to break the ice, your impressions of the campaign thus far and how it's shaping up as we head into primary season in January.
Well, it's not America's brightest moment when it comes to the field of political candidates, or I should say the likely nominees of the two parties. These are two candidates that the majority of the country doesn't want to see run, either of them run. And there are some within the Republican Party, certainly a more substantial block, that would not like to see Donald Trump as our nominee. And there are unfortunately few on the Democratic side, at least at this point, who don't see the obvious problem with their nominee. But both of these candidates are deeply flawed for a variety of different reasons. But they look like they are in this embrace that one needs the other. Biden needs Trump. Trump needs Biden. And both sides think that in a very tight race, one can beat the other. And so that's sort of the locked struggle that we have right now. And I think it's unfortunate. I think we could do far better on both sides of the aisle than the candidates that are the presumptive nominees at this point. At some point, there might be a break. Who knows? I mean, maybe the situation that we're experiencing in the Middle East and the problems that Joe Biden's presidency has wrought upon the world will shake the Democrats up, and the fracture that we're seeing in the Democratic Party from the far left could spawn something different. Who knows? But at this point, it looks like we're in an intractable embrace, and those two are going to symbiotically advance to the general election.
So what do you make of that? And what does it say about our current state of affairs that the front runners, and by some measures, are candidates that many people don't want, yet the prospects of clinching the nomination seem viable?
Yeah, to me, it all revolves around Trump. And there's a substantial base within the Republican Party that wants to see him nominated, that thinks he was a good president, or that he was railroaded out of office, or a variety of different things. the injustices, which I think are actually relatively true about how the media and the Justice Department and others here in the United States really did a horrible thing to him as president. And so they're sort of locked into this, whether they like him or they think he was done an injustice, feel like that he needs to right a wrong, if you will. And on the other side, the hatred for Donald Trump is I don't know if it's I've seen anything like it in American politics, of the uniform ire that they have against this president and fear that they have against President Trump. And so Trump motivates Republicans to vote, and frankly, even motivates Democrats to get out and vote and be against him. And since Biden was the successful candidate a few years ago, the logic is that he's the best person to beat them. Because as you see, and you're seeing here more recently, the younger generation, newer generation of Democrats are very radical. And the fear is among many of the establishment Democrats, who still by and large control the money in the party, that they're afraid of opening this thing up about what they get. I mean, Bernie Sanders may be the more moderate candidate of what might come out of a new Democratic process. So I think they're afraid of what they might get if the thing opened up. And so they're going to stick with what they know won last time and hope that he can drag him across the finish line this time.
I would like to chat in a bit more detail around two of the Republican candidates in particular, Mr. Trump and also Ron DeSantis. With respect to Mr. Trump, I mean, among the wide continuum and range of sentiments and perspectives that he provokes as a candidate and as an individual for that matter, there are dueling views and dueling perspectives within the flock, within the fold, if you will, both within the Christian population in America and the Catholic population as well. More to the point around what has been a trend of rather strong support for Mr. Trump among Catholic voters. What do you make of that now in a 2023 context relative to the support he may have enjoyed from Catholics back in 2016 or say even 2020?
It's hard to say because, again, you use the term Catholics, and that's somewhat of a meaningless term in the United States, and maybe it is in Canada too. But I mean, there are a lot of people who are nominally Catholic, but don't vote like a quote Catholic. I mean, they vote on their Catholic faith has nothing to do with the way they vote. And so, if you're talking about church going Catholics, which are more likely to be Republican, the support that Trump has among Catholics is as much, interestingly enough, is based on his record of what he did, particularly his Supreme Court nominations and some of the other things he did, which were consistent with Catholic teachings. The abomination that Joe Biden is as a Catholic, and the things he does that are very much against Catholic teaching, and yet maintains that he's a good Catholic boy. And so there's among I would say, the church-going Catholic community, there isn't much of a choice. One sort of pokes you in the eye, and the other, that's Biden, and sort of taunting you that he's a Catholic, and the other is sort of a begrudging understanding that Trump is better from a policy perspective, although I think a lot of Catholics just turn him off. I mean, they don't want to hear him. There's a personal uncomfortableness with his style and his personality and the way he does business. But when you have the alternative, they have no place else to go. And sort of the other group of Catholics, there's a when I say that there, I guess there's more than one other group of Catholics. I mean, there's Democratic Catholics who are just not Catholic at all, and like Nancy Pelosi and Joe Biden, who sort of bought into almost social gospel Catholicity, that are squarely within the Democratic Party. And then there's the folks in the middle who, you know, I think can, in some states and in some areas, could be up for grabs, who are maybe the occasional Catholic, the, you know, the Priester Catholics, who are still, you know, see themselves and identify, you know, with the Catholic Church. You know, those folks, they have traditionally been very much, you know, key swing voters in a lot of states that are important states like Pennsylvania and Michigan and Wisconsin, which have high Catholic populations. And those folks, in my mind, are still up for grabs.
May I ask, and this next question, rest assured, the spirit of this is not gotcha, but I know many church-going Catholics are in a similar position as you are. I believe you endorsed Mr. Trump in 2016.
Yeah.
You know, how do you, well, two-sided question. How do you reflect on that endorsement in hindsight? And do you have any intention to endorsement for this cycle?
So it's a bit of a story as to how I ended up endorsing Donald Trump. You know, I, as you may recall, I ran against him in 2016 and dropped out after a poor showing in the first primary state. And actually endorsed another candidate, Marco Rubio from Florida. And even though Trump had called me and asked me for his endorsement right after I got out, then after Rubio got out, and Trump called me again and asked me for my support, and I said no. And as other candidates got out, I would keep hearing from Trump, and I would keep saying no. I'm not going to endorse anybody. I'm sort of done with the endorsements. And then once Ted Cruz, who was the last person standing. And I think it was June of 2016. When he got out, Trump called me again. He said, "Well, now you can endorse me." And I said, "No, I really don't. I said, "I'm going to vote for you because you're going to be the Republican nominee, and I'll certainly make sure that nothing happens during the convention that will rob you of the nomination, which you justly won. But I'm not going to endorse you because I have concerns about you and the policies you'll pursue." And his response, "What do you mean? What, you know, what are you concerned about?" I said, "Well, so the most important thing for me, and if you recall, there was an open Supreme Court seat at the time. Anson Scalia had passed away. And I said, well, you know, the big concern is the Supreme Court." And he said, "Oh, I'll be great on the Supreme Court." And I said, "Well, yeah, you know, I'm sure you'll be great." And he said, "Well, you know, what I want to see before I endorse you is a list of the Supreme Court nominees that you'll support." And he said, "Well, I've been working on a list." I said, "Well, that's great." I said, "It's June. And to my knowledge, you've been working on that list since February and you still haven't published a list." And he said, "Well, you know, I'm working on it." And I said, "Well," he said, "Do you have," he said, "I don't have enough names." And he said, "Do you have any names?" And I said, "Well, yeah, sure. I've got people that I know and have a lot of respect for, and I'd be happy to send you some names." And he said, "Yes. Okay. You're going to send me some names." I said, "Yep. I'll send you some names." "Okay. So will you endorse me?" I said, "No." I said, "I'll send you the names, but I'm not going to endorse you and until I see the names that you're putting forward." And he said, "You know, I'm working with a couple of groups." I said, "Well, what groups are you working with?" And he said, "Well, I'm working with the Heritage. Have you ever heard of the Heritage Foundation?" I said, "Yes, I've heard of the Heritage Foundation." And he said, "Well, what do you think of them?" And I said, "Well, I think they're a pretty good group." And I said, "Who else?" And he said, "Have you ever heard of the Federalist Society?" And I said, "Yes, I've heard of the Federalist Society." And he said, "What do you think of them?" I said, "I think they're very good too." He said, "Okay, so you endorse me." And I said, "No." I said, "I want to see the list. I want to see it published. Once you publish a list and say that you will pick from that list as president, and if I like the names on the list, I'll endorse you." And she sort of hung up the phone, and I sent him a name with the next day. And 3 days later, he publishes the list. With the guy that I suggested on the list, as well as several other folks. And his office calls, you know, like 20 minutes after the list is released and says, "Well, you know, Mr. Trump, you know, wants to make sure you're going to endorse him." And I said, give me 24 hours to review the list and I'll do that. And so I did. And the list was a great list. And so I endorsed him. And that's how I ended up endorsing Donald Trump.
So the flip side of the question, for this campaign cycle, any intentions on your part to endorse candidates? That's an excellent story and anecdote, by the way. That's a lot of fun.
At this point, no. I mean, I've been pretty clear that I'd like to see someone other than Trump be the nominee, because I think that's the best opportunity to win, number one. And number two, I think, you know, given at least who some of the leading contenders are. I mean, I can't say that I'm enthusiastic about every Republican that's on out there, but there's two or three, maybe even four that I could certainly live with and be supportive of. I'd like to see one of those folks rise. And look, I think it's unlikely at this point, but I look back at my own campaign back in 2012 when I first ran for president, and I was sitting pretty much below everybody who's considered an alternative to Trump. I was way below them back then, and was able to come out and surprise people in Iowa. And I think there's still a fairly decent chance that somebody other than Trump wins the Iowa caucuses. Now, is that going to completely flip things on its head? No, but it will certainly create an opening for somebody, or maybe more than one person. And you know, I think there will be a little bit of there's a potential for a bit of drama and uncertainty before this thing is all settled on the Republican side.
This is the last question on Trump, I promise, and then we'll move on. And it is intended in a serious contemplative spirit. Again, recognizing facts for what they were. I mean, Mr. Trump was elected in 2016 with a good chunk of support from practicing Catholics and Christians, and I imagine there was similar support in the 2020 election. I don't want to put too fine a point on it or exaggerate things too much, but based on the record and the passage of time, events of January 6th, everything in between, do you think there's any coming to terms, or atonement may be too strong a word, but is there any coming to terms with support for Trump and the Trump administration that you think Catholics or Christians need to do, or is that just not a meaningful exercise at this point?
I it's always a meaningful exercise to reflect and assess the situation as to whether you made the right decision, particularly when you're going to be called on to make a decision of a similar nature. And I think what most people would tell you who are not all, but I think most believers will tell you that the alternative to whoever the Republican nominee is such a is wrought with such disastrous consequences, of which I think we're seeing now, both culturally. I mean, if you look at the culture and the divisions that are being caused by this intersectionality coalition that runs the Democratic Party. If you look at, what's happening to our border, if you look at what's happening to our national security, I mean, you can just go on down the list, and obviously to the pro-life movement and the like. I mean, there are serious consequences. As bad as Donald Trump is as a human being, and as flawed as he was as a president, those flaws are manageable compared to the devastating damage that the left is doing to this country, and frankly to your country, and one that I think we have an obligation to choose an imperfect vessel as opposed to one that we know is manifestly antithetical to everything that we believe in.
There is one candidate within the GOP field that I would like to pick your brain on a little bit. Again, rest assured, I'm not going to back you into a corner and say endorse, not endorse. But Governor Ron DeSantis from Florida, I do find to be a very intriguing, very compelling candidate. As an initial matter, he seems to be a serious Catholic and a person of faith. I've also been very impressed by genuine leadership and political courage that he's exhibited over the course of his service as governor. I mean everything from being on the vanguard of lifting unduly harsh restrictions in the midst of the COVID pandemic, the points that he's put on the board in terms of containing the nonsense, containing the damage and the fallout of the intersectional coalition, and you can go down the line. I mean as recently as being one of the only American authorities who's actually evacuated folks from the Middle East in the midst of the conflict. What are your general thoughts on Ron DeSantis, and what do you think he needs to do, and what needs to turn out in his favor for him to close the gap between him and the front runner, Mr. Trump?
It's a million-dollar question, because I think most people saw him, certainly early on, as someone who could really give Trump a run for his money because he had, yeah, I mean, you listed many of the positive attributes as a leader and as a governor, and he came off a big win in the 2022 election. I mean, he was people forget. I mean, a lot of voters have already forgotten how bad the 2022 election was for Republicans because of Donald Trump and because of the candidates he endorsed and the races he got involved with. You know, we lost the Senate again. We lost it in 2020 because of him. We lost it in 2022 because of him. And the one bright spot was DeSantis, who, and as well as Brian Kemp, who's the governor of Georgia, and a couple of other states that did remarkably well, who did not run with Trump and did not associate with Trump. New York, California, which is where we picked up our congressional districts, Trump stayed out of New York and California. That's one of the reasons our candidates did so well, because he wasn't an issue in the campaign. Pennsylvania, where I'm from, you know, we lost the Senate race because of Trump and his influence. And so it's sort of a bit of a quandary, a conundrum, maybe is a better word, for to understand why such a short memory. There's this allegiance to Trump, in part because the Democrats have done a masterful job of shifting away from the debates and discussions around Trump's effect on our elections and the effect of him with respect to his ability to win the presidency, and focus on the grievances that are legitimate grievances of how the media and how the Justice Department and this administration has treated Trump and the two-tiered system of justice that we're seeing here and the outrageous things that are done and said about Trump. And so it's a bit of a rally round the flag, and sort of ignoring the dispassionately ignoring some of the real problems that come with Trump, not just as him winning and him governing, but the impact on the party and the country writ large. And I wish DeSantis had what it took to sort of break through that. He certainly had his moment. He had his opportunity to do it, and he failed. I mean, he didn't connect with voters. He's not particularly good on the stump. He's not good interacting with people. He's very mechanical, and his operation is very insular. They don't listen to anybody. They don't. I won the Iowa caucuses back in 2012, with basically no money. I mean, less than $1 million I spent, not just in Iowa, but I spent in the year running up to the Iowa caucuses. And yet I was able to beat someone who spent literally tens of millions of dollars. And yet, you know, there's other candidates have reached out and, you know, said, you know, what can you do? What sort of advice? You know, nothing. I mean, it's sort of a not invented here mentality that just doesn't enamor people to him or volunteers and supporters. Having said all that, you know, there's still an opportunity, particularly in Iowa, where people do pay more attention to these things. I mean, it's one of the reasons I think Iowa is so important in our process, even though they don't always get it right with respect to who the nominee is going to be. I think if we'd listened to Iowa, and now I'm saying this as someone who won the Iowa caucuses, I think if we had listened to Iowa in the years that they did not pick the eventual winner, I would argue that those eventual winners went on to lose the presidency. And so, yeah, they may not have been good at picking the nominee, but they certainly didn't pick a loser. And we don't know whether I won or Mike Huckabee would have won or, you know, others, Ted Cruz would have won. But the point is, I think they do a better job of analyzing the situation than the typical Republican. And they may create an opportunity for DeSantis because he's doing some good things there. He's spending time there. He's got the governor of Iowa who hasn't endorsed him yet, but has been very, very friendly and everybody knows it. And she's the most popular person there. So there's still an opportunity for DeSantis to have his moment. And then let's see whether he's learned any lessons from the last time he had his moment, and maybe he can capitalize on it.
So I'll admit, one reason I'm intrigued by the prospect of a DeSantis nomination and candidacy is hypothetical, and I recognize there are limitations to the utility of hypotheticals, but humor me for just a moment. In the hypothetical situation that Ron DeSantis was the Republican nominee facing off against Joe Biden on the Democratic side, I believe that would be the first time in presidential history that you'd have two Catholic nominees squaring off against each other. Again, recognizing the limitations of this exercise, I'm curious to hear your thoughts on that prospect. I mean, I'll be honest, there's a part of me that relishes that, you know, papist versus papist. I think in itself, it would be healthy for the body politic. It would be healthy in terms of overcoming previous anti-Catholic discrimination in the United States. And then there's another part of me that absolutely dreads the prospect, particularly with an eye towards recognizing that that would just likely further inflame, you know, the internecine battles that are affecting the church at this moment. Your thoughts on all of that?
I think there's reasons for, just like, in a sense, the first major party nominee, Al Smith, when he was first nominated. I mean, it was a bright moment when Kennedy won as a Catholic. It was seen as a good thing for Catholics. On the other hand, having two major candidates both be Catholic is probably seen as a step forward for Catholics. I'd like Catholics to, one of the things I'm most concerned about with Catholics, and at least in the Republican Party, particularly Catholics who are influencers, if you will, is they tend, and this is why I think it would be a good thing, they tend to be followers. They want to be in the club because there's still a sense that Catholics are still not quite in the club when it comes to the conservative movement of the Republican Party. And so, I mean, I use the example of when I was running against Mitt Romney, who is, you know, is not a Catholic, he's a Mormon. And yet, even when I was seen as the, you know, it was down to the two of us, the general leadership within the Catholic community, both intellectual leaders as well, many of the intellectual leaders, not all, many of the intellectual leaders, and certainly the donors and the establishment were all for Romney. They weren't for the Catholic because I wasn't the guy, because the anointed folks, the folks who anoint within the party, had picked Romney. And so they want, so there's this sense of conservative Catholics to be part of the club, as if they still have to prove they're loyal to the team and not just loyal to the faith. And so hopefully with more nominations and more Catholics, and Catholics become more comfortable in their own skin within the Republican Party, which of course they weren't welcome in the party for a long, long time. Then I think you actually might get better and more and better conservative Catholic candidates coming out of the woodwork who have support, unlike me, who didn't have support of the elite Catholics within the conservative movement in the United States. So I see that as a potential positive of DeSantis, because he's this combination. I mean, most of the Catholics who run, whether it's me or Pat Buchanan and others, you know, we were sort of the outsider. We were the folks who were pushing up against the establishment, and as a result, really didn't get a lot of strong Catholic support as a result of that, because of the fear of bucking the establishment within the Catholic conservative community.
Yeah, and I think I should qualify my previous comments to say, it's one thing to enjoy the breakthrough of the glass ceiling and have two Catholic candidates lead their party into the election. Arguably, the more important thing is that any Catholic who's putting himself or herself forward for public office is doing justice to the faith and justice to the witness of what it means to be Catholic. And unfortunately, as you've spoken about, and as we are going to get to later, there are just so many deficiencies in that regard when it comes to Mr. Biden.
Well, Mr. Biden is no different than 99% of the Democrats who have been for decades in this country, and yet, moving on a little bit more within the church, I mean, the leadership of the Catholic Church has been in the back pocket of the Kennedy wing of the Democratic Party for a long, long time. And it's tragic to see it. And you know, you just see the, you know, a handful of bishops will stand up like Bishop Corleone did in San Francisco with Nancy Pelosi. But by and large, they shudder from not being included in the club and maybe it's their age, although you can see some younger bishops doing this, but maybe it's the idea that you know, Democrats were the party where Catholics were first accepted and they owe some allegiance to the Democratic Party. I don't know. But the Democratic Party that once welcomed Catholics now absolutely would like to burn them at the stake. and I say that figuratively, not literally, but there's no tolerance at all for a traditional Catholic worldview within the Democratic Party. And they are in fact heretics. And it's not recent. I mean, you go back to 1992 and Bob Casey, who was the governor of Pennsylvania, who wanted to speak at the national convention was banned from doing so. And that was 30 years ago that happened. And even then they mentioned it, the media mentioned it, but they sort of shoved it off. Well, you know, it's just not who we are anymore. And we are not going to tolerate anybody who doesn't toe the leftist line and increasingly progressive and woke line that the Democratic Party has. Well, I should say it's a Marxist line the Democratic Party has become.
I want to round out our conversation regarding the 2024 presidential sweepstakes. Two other things that I'd really love to hear from you on. What's your sense of the ballot box question that's shaping up? Whether you interpret that from the perspective of what you think the ballot box question will be for the public at large, you know, what's going to be the biggest question upon which the outcome of the election could hinge?
You don't know until you're there, because obviously look at what happened over the last 2 weeks, and I don't think anyone would have thought that we'd be talking about Iran and the axis of evil and national security and what, I mean, that has, you know, who knows whether, I think very likely that there will be terrorist attacks here in this country, that the United States could get pulled in other theaters. There's a lot going on there. So it's hard for me to say, you know, what November of 2024 is going to look like, but certainly what happened in Israel is going to have an impact, even for some miraculous reason, things somehow work out in a way that everybody's happy, which of course will not happen. This will still resonate and have an impact on this next election. And particularly, I think to the negative effect to Joe Biden. You know, typically elections in the United States revolve around economic issues, and we still have very high interest rates here. Inflation is still twice what it was, what the target is, and still much higher than what people are used to. And you know, we have strikes that are affecting lots of sectors of the economy. We have the border, which is a huge issue for a variety of different reasons, everything from crime to the welfare system that we've created in this country that in many cases treats illegal immigrants better than we do poor Americans in this country. So there are a variety of issues, but I the Democrats are going to try to make this issue about two things. Number one, abortion. And number two, that Donald Trump is a threat to our democracy. And they were successful in 2022 in making the election about that. So that's going to be their aim, because if the issue is the economy, they lose. If the issue is the border, they lose. If the issue is national security, they lose. If the issue is personal competence to do the job, they lose. So they have to talk about things. They have to create issues I mean, the abortion issues, look, it's an important issue, but it's a fairly stable issue right now. I mean, yes, there might be a few states that pass some limited restrictions going forward. But unfortunately in America, you can, you know, most Americans, they may have to travel to a different state, but most Americans can get an abortion and get it fairly easily. And in fact, many employers and the government, you know, if you're in the military, will pay for people to travel to states to get abortions if you can't procure one in the state that you're living in. So it's the actual hardship is not really the issue. It's the perception that the Democrats are trying to project. And it's harder to do when there are other issues that are actually real and affecting people directly. And I think in 2022 that, you know, this was not as big a deal. You know, all these other issues were not as important as they are now. And so the answer is, I don't know. But I can tell you, if the narrative is the narrative around Donald Trump was a threat to democracy and a threat to your individual freedoms of abortion, then, you know, Republicans are going to have a hard time winning. If it's anything else, I think Republicans should do fine. When I say fine, I'm, you know, if Trump's a nominee, we're not going to have a big win. It's not going to be Ronald Reagan in 1980, even though arguably Joe Biden is far worse a president than Jimmy Carter ever was. And the situation is far more dire than certainly internationally and culturally than what Jimmy Carter was dealing with. But, you know, Trump is not Ronald Reagan. Trump is not a uniting figure within, frankly, either party.
Truer words were never spoken. It would be remiss of me, having the privilege of you on the show, talking about presidential campaigns, not to spend a few minutes just asking for your personal reflections. You've contested two presidential elections as a candidate. As we've mentioned already, you were runner-up in the Republican primary in 2012. For the benefit of our listeners, speak to aspects, and if you're willing to, kind of in a personal way, what participation in a presidential campaign means for the candidate, for their families, the sacrifices and the tolls involved.
Well, I can speak to mine. I mean, I think other people have other experiences. If you're Michael Bloomberg, the impact to you and to your family is fairly limited because you have billions of dollars and you can travel around in first class airplanes and you know, the hardship to your family is non-existent, other than the fact that maybe they're getting a little even more publicity than they normally got. But if you're someone like me who went through the United States Senate when I was there, and Congress and Senate when I was there from ages 32 to 48, and unlike Joe Biden, I didn't become rich being a United States Senator. You know, I left office with pretty much the same balance sheet that I had when I came into office. I had six children, and you know, eventually had a seventh child, and our child was special needs, and you know, she's 2 years old, and all of a sudden I come up with this crazy idea that God's calling me to do this. And so, you know, my situation was very different in the sense that I didn't have resources. I wasn't someone who was being encouraged by anybody. You know, only one of the seven members of my family encouraged me to run. And shortly after I announced, this is my 13-year-old daughter, she retracted and said, no, I don't want you to run anymore. So it was not like I was encouraged to run, that I had lots of financial and other support. It just felt like I had a message and a vision, and that I thought that was something that was missing from the field of candidates out there. And I thought I could do something to change the debate in this country. And so, and potentially, you know, I didn't think the candidate that we were about to nominate, Mitt Romney, was going to win. And so I felt it was critical because I knew Barack Obama. I had served with Barack Obama. I knew how dangerous he was in the first 4 years and was convinced he was going to be even more radical, which of course he was, in the next 4 years. So I felt like I couldn't sit on the sideline and allow what I saw pretty clearly was going to happen, which is, you know, we were going to end up reelecting him. And so I got in, and it was hard. You know, when you run for president, you really can't work because you're out there running for president. So, you know, borrowed money, not to run my campaign, but to survive as a family. And, you know, my kids were, at least initially, you know, my newly minted high school graduate daughter was responsible for getting me on the ballot in all 50 states with her and her best friend from high school. The story's never been written because the media doesn't write stories about conservative Don Quixotes who actually knock over the windmill. I mean, you know, we actually did. I mean, we actually almost won this thing, and the miracle that it was. I mean, it was just that. It was a miraculous thing, but it was the hardship on the family and financially and with the kids and with Karen, and it was hard. And particularly, you know what made it really hard? I'll be really a moment of candor here. The hardest thing for us as a family was the lack of Catholic support that we got in the race. I mean, it was just devastating to us that someone who had sort of worn our faith, in particular our Catholic faith, on our sleeve and tried as best we could to publicly witness to that and stay and stick very closely adhere to the moral teachings of the church in the public square, as well as try to do your best within your own personal life to be, you know, an example of what a Catholic politician was supposed to be, and to see friends, you know, who you've known for years, look and say, yeah, well, you know, we're not going to elect people like you. I mean, someone like you, you know, who's that openly Catholic, you can't win. I mean, there was just this sense within the Catholic community that we're not worthy, and that the country isn't ready for us. And so they ran to a Mormon from Massachusetts to be the nominee. And that probably, from a psychological point of view, not as much me, because I've known these people for a long time and I knew what to expect. But I think to my wife and to a lot of the folks in our community, our Catholic community, it was sort of a shocking revelation as to how much Catholics in some respects are still in the ghetto here in the United States.
I admit that's shocking for me to hear. I was not expecting you to go there. I thought you might have some other trials or tales of tribulations and what. I appreciate that. And it's actually relevant where I wanted to go next, because I mean, just in terms of all the demands and pressures of a campaign and being in the public spotlight, and you had the benefit of having served many terms in Congress and the legislative branch and being prepared and having your backbone stiffened. But nevertheless, I can't help but think for anyone in that situation, there's temptations to compromise or rationalize or to engage in certain tactics that you might normally not take, but might convince yourself that it might be necessary for positioning yourself more favorably and fighting the good fight. And I was curious to ask you, to resist that temptation and to resist all those pressures, you know, who do you lean on? And obviously your family, your wife and the like, but you know, for a candidate, and particularly a Catholic candidate like yourself, you know, who's your inner circle and who do you look to help hold you to account? And I would have thought that there would have been some solidarity with your co-religionists when it came to that particular need.
Yeah, there wasn't. And certainly, I mean, you mentioned the most important person, which is my wife and my family. And, you know, I'm just very, very blessed to have an incredibly faithful wife and one who, we sort of came to the faith together as dating and as young married people. And that's been, you know, the greatest blessing of my life. is that that foundation was built together, and that God is very much at the center of our marriage and holds everything together through, trust me, we've had our share. I've put my wife and family through a lot, obviously, in the political career that I have, but I was lucky because, I was in the arena for a long time before I ran for president. I mean, I served 2 terms in Congress and 2 terms in the Senate, and was in leadership in the Senate, was fighting major battles on life and marriage and a whole host of other cultural issues that put me in to the crosshairs of the national media. I don't think anyone's experienced what Trump experienced, but I think I may have set the standard before Trump. For the kind of abuse that conservative candidates got. So I sort of had a network of folks who were senior folks in my staff when I was in the Senate and people who were sort of kitchen cabinet, if you will, on our campaigns. I can't say the way you asked that question sounds so dramatic, and yet it wasn't from my mind. I mean, this was, I always used to say, in fact, I was just talking to someone who's contemplating running for speaker here, and he reached out to me and made the comment that I was a role model for him and that he was going to behave as speaker, based upon some of the precepts that I had talked about and done. And it's just one of those things that becomes, it sounds dramatic, will you compromise? You did. Well, first, of course, you compromise. I mean, it's part of the process. But you don't compromise and do something that's evil. You compromise to do maybe something that's less good, but never compromise to do something that's objectively bad. I mean, that's not a compromise. That's a capitulation. And so, I sort of, like I said, I'd been through the mill. I knew what was on a national scale. I mean, obviously, presidential candidate's bigger than anything, but I had pretty good training to know what to expect, and I can say that nothing really got me to the point where I had to have one of those contemplative moments. Everyone sort of knew. I mean, it's one of the things. I mean, I talk about it with respect when I talk at men's conferences. People say, "Are you tempted?" Beautiful women come up to you. And I said, "No, because they don't," and because you don't give anyone the impression that you would be the least bit interested. And you sort of have to understand that your behavior influences other people's behavior. And so everybody in our team knew. I mean, they wouldn't even think of doing something that would be thought of as edgier, because that's just not how we do things.
Well, I appreciate you sharing all that so heartfeltly. And I also appreciate your shout out to your wife. I don't do that enough on this show, so you tipping your hat to Karen is inspiring me for me to tip my hat to Marianne and expressing support. Amen. Expressing thanks for all the support that she lends. So God bless the wonderful wives in our lives. And I do want to segue from this point as well, because I wanted to make sure to spend some time to pick your brain. Your experience in the legislative branch, I'm curious to know, was there a sense of Catholic camaraderie or a sense of camaraderie amongst the Catholics, perhaps in your party, but even across party lines during your time on Capitol Hill?
I would say the answer to that question is sort of 99% no. There was a time where there was a sense of Catholic camaraderie that I think was genuine. And that's when a group of senators, of which I was honored to be one of, we represented the Senate at John Paul II's funeral. And so we were all playing together. We all, sort of went to the event together. And, there were people there who, Kennedy was there, John Kerry was there. I can list the folks, John Boehner, another Catholic. They were all there with me. And, at that moment, we were all just in awe of the moment and moved by the moment, and the waves of from starting way in the back of Santo Subito coming over us, and you could hear it just building, and it just all of us were
were shaken by it and moved by it. And so in that respect, yes, I mean, there was that identity of being a Catholic, and obviously an incredible moment. It sort of ended there. It began there and ended there. And, you know, I thought even entered into my mind, maybe this could have an impact on how these people see the world, but it doesn't. They quickly go back into your camp, into your tribe, and it's a tribe that is incredibly hostile to Catholic thinking and Catholic moral teachings.
This is a simplistic question, but your response prompts the follow up. So, what do we do about that? What's the solution to get over that hump and hurdle? How do we foster greater camaraderie and solidarity amongst the amongst Catholics on Capitol Hill?
I don't hold out much hope for that, and I don't candidly don't see a path forward there. I mean, I hate to say this, but I've come to the conclusion that, you know, when you're in a war, sometimes you just have to defeat the enemy. That the enemy is not of goodwill. The enemy is not seeking to find some sort of agreement based on goodwill and based on truth. You can fight for what you're fighting for. You can stand up and have debates. And, you know, unfortunately, I mean, in many of the debates I had on the floor of the United States Senate on these important cultural issues, you know, folks standing up opposing me were Catholic. And so, you know, not Joe Biden being one of them, but many others. So Kennedy, I mean, you can go on down the list. And so I just don't think we pine for a day when people who have so, like Pelosi and Biden and Kerry and everybody who so have just, you know, angrily rejected everything that the church teaches, that somehow or another, you know, it should be an objective of ours to I mean, those of us in politics. I'm not saying the clergy, I'm not saying anybody else. I mean, but I think the clergy is stuck with where Corleone is, which is, you know, you're not doing them a favor by coddling them. I mean, they need correction, and they need clear correction. And I'm not sure that all the years of coddling them that the episcopy has done here in this country has done anything but embolden them to take even more radical positions.
Two names which I do want to run by you and just get your thoughts or any good stories. I mean, your time in Congress did overlap with two individuals who are considered among the great Catholic statesmen of the 20th century, Daniel Patrick Monaghan and Henry Hyde. What was the nature of your interactions or relationship with those gentlemen?
I actually had in some respects, I almost felt like at the time it was sort of a father-son or big brother, little brother relationship with Henry Hyde. I mean, we were not close, but our interaction, because we dealt in the same area of in the pro-life movement, you know, he was, I could sit and listen to Henry Hyde talk, hours on end. He was just so, he actually, when I first came to the House, this was back in 1991, he gave, the freshman talk, if you will, an opening, I actually got a copy of that speech and kept it for a long time. It was so eloquently stated and beautifully constructed, and the, you know, the wisdom and the counsel there, I just thought was incredible. And I had known of Henry Hyde before I came to the Congress, not that much, but he's someone that I would look to and listen to for wisdom, for guidance. Usually, I mean, yeah, we interact on a personal level many times, but we weren't friends. I mean, we were very different generations. Henry was probably in his 70s. I was 32. And so it was just a sort of from afar in many respects. Even when I came to the Senate and, you know, we dealt on the issue, frankly, of the Clinton impeachment, that was our last interaction that we had. It was a, it was a, it was a big brother type of relationship I had with him, and a one of great respect and trust of each other. And so he was very encouraging to me for the stances I was taking, and that was a great comfort to him, to me, to have that. Moynihan, he was a delightful fellow. He was a liberal's liberal. He wasn't a woke progressive. I think he'd be appalled by what's happened to the Democratic Party. The one anecdote I have about Daniel Patrick Moynihan was that, I was the leader on the partial birth abortion bill in the United States Senate, and Moynihan from New York obviously was a scion of the Senate, and like I said, the liberal's liberal. After the debates that I had, Moynihan came over and told me that that I had convinced him that, that this was something that, we shouldn't tolerate in this country. And he voted against his party and voted to ban the procedure. So they were still, even though we differed, and he was certainly not a pro-life warrior by any stretch, he was someone that had a sense, some sense of right and wrong and willingness to stand up to the tribe that I deeply respected. And he was obviously incredibly bright.
Yeah, I've read previously, and we've had on our program previously, George Weigel, who's written about the great what if, what Moynihan could have done for the cause. Oh. and if he had felt that pro-life conviction more. Well, we're almost at the end of our time here. Just the last question I was hoping to get your thoughts on. If there's a young American boy or girl, a teenager, young adult who's listening, practicing Catholic, church going, discerning the political vocation, what counsel would you offer? Particularly in this moment of ours, around resisting the direction we can often go down around politicizing the faith or bringing politics into our faith to an unhealthy degree in an untype of way. But what kind of counsel would you give a young Catholic American discerning the vocation?
Yeah, I mean, to pick up on what you just said, don't bring the politics into the faith, but bring the faith into politics. It has every right to be there. In fact, the fact that we haven't had there, and we haven't been courageous enough to understand that the left's religion, like I said, intersectionality, wokeism, whatever it is, it's a faith. I mean, it's a system of beliefs that is incredibly destructive to humankind, and that we need to take the truth of the church and stand up for it. I'm not saying go there and quote the catechism or quote the Bible, although that had been done in the past and was something that was accepted. So I'm not saying don't do it, but make the arguments. I always John Paul II. You have faith and reason, and if your faith is true and your reason is right, they're going to be the same. And so use the power, the gifts that God's given you to stand up and be courageous. And a caution I would give, frankly, is a caution not to be fearful, not to be wrapped up in conspiracies and thoughts about, the folks on the other side, many of them are not good people. I mean, I'll be honest with you, not good people. And what they're professing is objectively evil in many cases. I mean, we're cutting little children up, in the name of transsexualism. I mean, there's objective evil going on, but one of the things we can get wrapped up in is getting in that ghetto, in that gutter of just hopelessness and sort of this titanic struggle with evil. I mean, one of the things my wife, who is, as I mentioned before, just an incredibly huge advisor to me was, you know, to be the happy, hopeful warrior. You know, you're a warrior. I mean, you're not going to back down from what you believe in, but, you know, Christianity is a religion of hope. I mean, it's, you know, we know that Christ has redeemed the world. We know that we all have a path to heaven and forgiveness. And so we need to be that hopeful person. We need to be that person that paints the vision of what a good life is, and not back away, but don't get into it. One of the concerns I have with the right in America today is that it is just so negative and so fatalistic that as a result, you know, you start hearing these things that we talked about earlier. Well, you know, sometimes, and I hear this from some of Catholic conservatives on the radio, which is, well, sometimes you just got to get down in the gutter with them and do what they do. No, you don't. No, because as I've said many times, you know, if you do evil to attain good and you win, what do you win? If you've broken the rule of law in order to maintain the law, what have you won? And so it's really important for us to understand that I've learned this many times in my life, that losing it from an earthly perspective, you know, I always say that I see what I see in front of me, and I've lost elections, I've lost bills, I've lost so many more times than I've won, particularly if you look back over the last 30 years and in public life of the battles that I've fought. I mean, I've lost almost all of them. And yet I have seen in every one of those situations has how God has used that for victory. He's used that for wins, and wins that I couldn't even contemplate, wouldn't even think to contemplate at the time I was engaged in these battles. So, you know, Mother Teresa's right. God calls us to be faithful, not successful. And so I just encourage people to keep that in mind, you know, we're here for a short time, really, really short time. And your soul is more important than the victory at hand.
Amen. I can't think of a better place to leave off our conversation. Rick, this has been a real treat. Thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule. Really appreciate you joining us.
Thank you, Patrick. God bless you.
Thanks so much for tuning in. If you're enjoying Crown and Crozier, don't forget to subscribe to our show wherever you get your podcasts. And we'd be grateful if you could help us reach more listeners by leaving us a rating or referring us to a friend. Also, we'd love to hear from you. Check out our website at crownandcrozier.com. Or drop us a line on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram. We're sincerely grateful for your support, and we look forward to providing you with future episodes on church, state, and faithful citizenship.